listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Grassroots, community-supported, volunteer, solar-powered, and all sorts of good things radio.
Yeah, on a beautiful day.
On a beautiful day in Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. And we have a most interesting book today. It really was.
Yeah, Mom, you want to introduce our guest today?
Okay, this is, we're going to be talking to Robert Sessions, a native of South Dakota. He earned his BA from Drake University and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Michigan. He has taught philosophy and humanities in four colleges, including 26 years at Kirkwood Community College in Iowa City. He is a co-author of Working in America, a humanities reader, and has published articles on environmental philosophy and philosophy of work and the philosophy of technology. Bob is a proud father of five children and grandfather of three. He lives in Iowa City with his wife, Lori Erickson. So he's an Iowa native. Well, he's not an Iowa native,
not
but he's
Iowa
an
native,
Iowa
but,
person.
But we'll claim him.
Yeah, we'll claim him. You better believe it.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Bob.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book.
Well, that's an interesting story. The book is really a kind of capstone book on a long teaching career. I just retired this fall, and simultaneously the book came out. It's sort of a fun story. 3 years ago in April, I was at a dinner party. The guest there was a person who was supposed to be a psychic, and I'm not a particular believer in such, but at the end of the evening, my wife asked her to go around the room and do a reading on each of the people there. And I hadn't been involved in any conversations with her and hadn't had many encounters. She was sitting at another end of the table. And she came to me and looked at me for a long time, and she asked, "Well, why aren't you writing the book you're supposed to be writing?" I've been teaching at a community college for 25 years, and what we do is teach, 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 and writing is not that highly prized, and we don't have much time for it. But there was just this flood of recognition that, indeed, I have a book in me, and I want to write it. And I knew almost instantly as well what the topic was going to be. So it was a very interesting kind of calling experience to have that rush forth. All it took was a question from a perfect stranger.
Wow. Did she remain a stranger, or did she become a friend as a result of that?
Oh, I let her know that the book was coming out, and she's a friend of a friend. That's why I was at the party.
Right.
And so, we stay in touch slightly, but she really only had that role in the book.
Well, I think we should say the title of the book, too, which is Becoming Real, Authenticity in an Age of Distractions, and we certainly have distractions.
So you said that you knew immediately what the topic would be. Why this topic?
Well, I've worked on a lot of different issues, social, political, spiritual, philosophical, of course, over a lot of years. And there wasn't one thing that seemed to tie all of those things together, but this topic of authenticity really fits that bill. I'm convinced that it's a very useful concept. I did my dissertation and quite a bit of writing on the concept of freedom, and I'm not sure that that concept's a particularly useful concept. For one reason, for example, Alfred Adler years ago did a study on different concepts of freedom and decided there were well over 4,000 different meanings in our culture to the word freedom, and so it's very difficult to use that kind of language very successfully in communicating, whereas authenticity hadn't been so overused in so many ways. Secondly, authenticity, I think, gets at something that's very, very important in people's lives that people are hungry for, and that's a sense of being connected, of being genuine, of having real solidity to their character and identity. And that's a very difficult thing to come by. And what I try to do in my book is to help people understand what sorts of things, often very practical things, stand in the way of authenticity. And notice, I don't think it's a conspiracy theory. I say we live in a world of distractions, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And so I talk about work, how that can enhance one's growing authenticity, or it can get in the way, which is what I think usually happens. I have a chapter on technology, and of course we are all inundated with the allure of many, many different kinds of technologies that distract us from paying much attention to most anything. I have a chapter on nature, which I want to read from in a few minutes. I think that our distance from nature has kept us from authenticity, or becoming authentic. And I also believe that part of our problem is that we are conceptually confused about authenticity. Mm-hmm. Large chapter on that. And then finally, I try to offer a positive view of authenticity that I think replaces most theories that people have and is much more satisfactory.
Well, the paragraph on the back cover, I think, explains pretty well what this book is about. Caroline, do you want to share that with our readers,
okay,
our listeners?
Right here, this one.
Yeah.
We live in a frenzied world. Well, we know that. Many of us find that the relentless pace and constant distractions of our lives greatly limit our abilities to do anything well, including forming an authentic identity. Being authentic is such a struggle that many people have given up the quest for an integrated whole self. Becoming Real, this book, addresses this critical personal and cultural crisis. And a lot of people probably don't even realize that they're in a crisis, but they're not, they don't feel good, but they don't know why.
And you talk about that quite a bit in the early chapters too, don't you, Bob? About, you know.
Yeah, I think one of the values of a study like this can be that, you know, when you name something and name it accurately, there can be a real recognition, and it can be very helpful just knowing what you're, what ails you. And
right.
Often we can have things going on, and, you know, after a while, a state of uncertainty, a state of anomie becomes so normal in you and other people that you don't realize something is askew.
Now, Bob, you mentioned that a lot of your earlier work was on the concept of freedom. And I can't put my finger right on the page right now, but I found a really interesting section in your book about kind of the conflict almost between freedom and authenticity, in mm-hmm. that many people think that identify in our culture, they identify freedom with the concept of individual liberty, being able to do whatever you want and not really not thinking about anyone else but yourself. And so maybe some people think that that is how to be authentic. To be true to yourself means ignoring the consequences of your actions on the rest of society. And you're pointing out how untrue that is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to discuss that a little bit?
Yeah. Authenticity has to do with becoming and being who you are. I know it sounds kind of strange. Well, of course, we are who we are, right? So the idea of becoming who you are sounds a little odd, but I think it's a helpful notion because, you know, we develop, and we don't come full-born being, you know, the selves that we eventually become. It takes years and years of experience and hard work. We basically have two views of authenticity in our culture. They're kind of at opposite ends of a pole, having to do with personal identity. On the one end is the view that there is an essential inner core self that we can only get to by peeling away layers like we might layers of an onion. And that what's going on is society and culture tend to mask that or corrupt it or discolor that true inner core self. There's this gem inside of us. While I think that point of view is partly true in that each of us is born with unique gifts and characteristics, I think it's decidedly one-sided and very partial. And on the other end, there's this view, it's kind of a mirror of the first, and that's that the only way to become a true self is to undermine the overlays of society and culture. And that view is one that the existentialists, for example, hold. And they contend, if you read them at all carefully, that basically as we throw off the yokes that society and culture lay on us, we can't help but become unhappy because we become outsiders. There's a book, several books by a guy named Colin Wilson that are focused on that idea of the outsider. Both views, I think, are wrong. The latter view believes there is no inner core self. All there is freedom, which comes around then to your question. And the idea then is that we individually are stuck with constructing this self, whole cloth, out of nothingness. And that, of course, whatever we end up with is something that has nothing to do with any inner core self. There's a rejection of that. But it's the best we can do. And the main thing is to not be guided or ruled by our social connections. My view is that the self that we become is this very complex play between our natural characteristics and our cultural characteristics, that we are social beings through and through. That's part of our natural characteristics. But it also then, the identities that we form are formed because we live in a particular society, a particular subculture, a particular family, a particular community, and so on. And that those are not foreign to us. Those are a deep, rich part of who we are. And so we throw off the yoke, if you will, of culture and society. When we do that, or try to do that, what we're doing is throwing away the very basic building blocks of the self that we need if we're to become really authentic.
So how do you become authentic if neither of these ways work?
Yeah. That, you have to read the book. The path that I think makes the most sense is I call it the in-between, in between the essentialist and the non-essentialist points of views, and the path in which we work hard at it. We pay attention to who we are, including our social identity, our roles in society, and so on. I have a whole section where I try to undermine the notion that if you play your role, we have this negative image of role-playing, then you can't be authentic. And I think the real issue is whether or not we play our role in a way that is genuine and you sort of truly dive into it. In other words, play your role the best you can. You can't help but be your parent's child, okay? The question isn't whether you're going to have that role, it's how you're going to play that role. And I think that's what authenticity includes, among many other things.
Well, the way that you have the book organized, I think, is good, because you approach it from the things that we are all involved in: work, technology, nature, philosophical reflections, happiness, which I found that chapter interesting, that poem that you have in there, and so it. It takes you through your life and how you can relate to authenticity in all these different aspects of your life, because everybody has all these facets.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Bob Sessions, the author of Becoming Real: Authenticity in an Age of Distractions. And this is published by Ice Cube Press, one of our favorite publishers.
Yeah.
So, Bob, the content of Becoming Real is somewhat academic, and that makes sense since you have a very strong academic background. It includes critiques of other books and philosophies, but it's written in a very personal voice, which incorporates some elements of memoir. So you use personal stories, spiritual ruminations, and philosophical analysis all together. Did you have any models for this style of writing?
Yeah. One of the good things that's come out of so-called postmodernism is the realization that, yes, we are after truths that have, staying power and that can really help us, work through various things, whether it's in science or sociology or whatever. But at the same time, we always are speaking from a particular point of view, a particular life story, a particular voice. And so there are quite a few philosophers writing these days who write in a similar style. I don't claim to be as good a writer as many of them, but one example is Kathleen Dean Moore, who is a philosopher from Washington State, and she has just wonderful accounts of her experiences while she's simultaneously making very serious philosophical points. A person who was very much a guide for me is now dead. His name is Henry Bugbee. He wrote a book called Inward Mourning, which I found to be philosophically very challenging, but it was written in a pretty personal voice style. He tried to write as close to, the original thought and not greatly embellish it with footnotes and academic style and so on, and so it has this very strong personal sense of what thinking is all about, and that's of course why people like myself and many others get into something like philosophy, is that it's not just abstract and impersonal, it's very personal.
How closely linked, one of the chapters in here is on happiness, how closely linked are authenticity and happiness? Would you say that if someone is happy, then by definition they must be living authentically?
Yeah, that's a tough chapter in some ways, that laying out what contemporary psychological theorists call positive psychologists, positive in the sense that a lot of psychology up until 15, 20 years ago was all about abnormal psychology, people with maladies and problems and so on. And so what is a normal psychology like? And so positive psychology is about that. And there's a lot of focus on happiness. And they've done cross-cultural longitudinal studies for about 50 years now on happiness and find great similarities across all the data that they've collected. And so happiness is not nearly as mysterious from their point of view as people kind of historically have said it is. It's one of those things, you know it when you see it, but you don't have any idea what it's about. They're saying, no, that's simply not true. With that background, then, what I try to show is that one of the underlying conclusions of especially the existentialist tradition, and that is if you're going to be authentic, to be truly yourself and not hide behind the masks and roles and pretense that we're all familiar with in our social relations, then you can't be happy, because to be happy is to try to appease others and make them like you and gain their recognition and so on, and you're not being your true self. The happiness study people indicate that because at least half of who we are and what our happiness is about is a function of our sociality. They call us hypersocial among primates even. Then that simply can't be true. Spending time with and relating to other people and being a part of a social group and getting your identity and your meaning through social relationships is what humans do. This is who we are. And so you can be who you are and not be unhappy. So that's the short version of that chapter.
I would almost argue that if you're unhappy, then what's the point of being who you are if it makes you unhappy?
People have long said that about the existentialists. Let those people go off and be unhappy.
Yeah,
I do think, though, that it's really important to take them seriously because they are pointing out the ways in which, you mentioned freedom before, one of the most important insights of people like Sartre is that we humans claim that we want to be free, but we don't really want to. You know, we want all the claims, but don't want to do the hard work. I mean, think about that in a political context. Okay, Americans say they highly prize their freedom and so on, and then to get people to actually be citizens in a full-fledged version is very difficult. Those are rare people who are willing to put in the time and effort it takes to be a free person living in a free society, because in the end, what being a citizen is about is sort of like an endless committee meeting. You know, it's just hard work for the body politic. That's what freedom is about.
Well, how many people don't even?
I think that's an important insight that they're offering up.
How many people don't even vote? You know, exercise their right to vote.
Yeah, they don't do the basic, the very minimal.
A lot of people.
Right.
Yeah.
They're the ones that complain the loudest.
And also, you know, we say freedom is we hold freedom as sort of the highest value in America, but freedom also means that having to think for yourself, which a lot of people don't want to take the time and trouble to do. And really, you know, learn and understand and make the decisions for themselves. And so you end up with these with groups of people, you know, people aligning themselves with some group that they may not really even agree with the underlying assumptions and goals of the group, but it allows them to take the shortcut of not having to think through things themselves.
Oh, sure. And the advertisers, of course, whether they're advertising political products like senators or congressmen or you know, physical products we buy, the advertisers full well understand that. What people want and operate with is shorthand, is something easy, cliches and associations and images and so on. That's powerful and dangerous stuff that we're dealing with, both in, you know, our commercial and in our political activities.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot to say in Becoming Real about media, in your chapter in technology, I believe, is where you talk a lot about media. Do you want to just give us a broad brush stroke of your view of how media affects our ability to be authentic?
Yeah. One example I use in that chapter is about cool. Cool is the coinage of successful identity for, you know, many people, especially young people in our society. People want nothing more than to be cool. And to be cool, of course, is to be like somebody who we think is cool, but to have our own flair. Here's the rub with being cool. I believe authenticity has to do with developing, and it's often, as I say, very hard work, a strong character and personality. In a real sense, to be identifiable, to be predictable, to be able to say, hey, Monica, you can always trust her to do, to believe, to say such and such, okay? In a sense, you know, it goes contrary to the idea of cool, because being cool is all about polishing your surface, making sure that your jeans have just that right hole in the knee, or that right tattoo on your arm, or the right earrings, or you know, whatever it might be. And you have to constantly look at the trends and the fads and be just one half step ahead. And it's a very cruel God, because you can be cool one moment and the next not, because all of a sudden everybody's got holes in their jeans or that same kind of tattoo.
And it's just not cool anymore.
Right. Yeah, it's a very fickle God. But it not only fails you that way, it fails you in your need and desire to be an authentic person, to be real. Because being real is all about, as I say, sinking down into your character, becoming somebody who is predictable, who is not at the whim of every fad that blows through, but instead, you know, has something deeper going on. One way to put it is that cool is about our surface or our exterior, and character and authenticity are about our depth or our interiority. My favorite example of this in literature is Gregor Samsa, Kafka's Metamorphoses, in which this character who one day is the wage-earning son in his family goes off it's all about going and doing business and so on, and he comes home and he's transformed. Now, Kafka turns him into a bug, you know, very famous dung beetle, but, you know, he could be somebody who was in a tragic accident and loses, you know, use of his limbs, or he's disfigured in a fire or something like that. But Gregor had spent so much time focused on how he looks and how he comes across that he didn't develop his interiority, and so when he becomes a bug, he basically slithers underneath a bed and dies. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't do anything with his transformed life because he has no developed interiority. Mm. That's my concern with the endless pursuit that so many people have of technology. I'm not anti-technology. I taught a course for 25 years and created this course called Culture and Technology, and I understand that technologies are very much what human beings are. We're technological beings through and through, but technologies are a double-edged sword in this regard. They can dominate our lives, and often they become emblems of cool, as you know, the pursuit of the endless iPhone, iPad, etc., you know, is showing us these days. You know, you got to have the one with the right apps and the right colors and so on.
Now, so it keeps us from being authentic then, depending on that.
Although I would argue that being cool and being authentic are not necessarily mutually exclusive, because to me the coolest person is the one who is cool not because they're following the fad, but because they're setting the fad. It becomes cool because they are that or have that.
Uh-huh. And well, of course, cool, you're using the word, you know, like I was accusing the word freedom of being used, can be used in many ways.
Right.
Yeah, I think the ultimate cool person is the Dalai Lama, okay?
Absolutely, yeah.
But he's not cool because, he has the latest gizmos or is a cultural pop star or something like that. It's because truly of his depth of character, his predictability, and the genuineness of his development.
True, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Okay. Could you in the chapter about happiness, you refer to the noontime demon. Can you expand on that a little bit? I know that was also in your in the chapter about work, but can you explain that?
Yeah, of course, this is a medieval idea, but Kathleen Norris, in a recent book called Acedia and Me, turns back around on this idea. Usually, acedia, which is a Latin word, is translated as slothfulness. Okay, the poor sloth gets a bad image here.
Yeah.
And the noontime demon is what comes over people in monasteries, for example, who, you know, have really put in an effort since 3 a.m. to pray and work and be mindful and develop themselves spiritually. And you get to that middle of the day and you just don't feel like doing anything. What's the point? Does God really exist and so on? And that demon overcomes everybody in that kind of situation. Norris does something really interesting. She says, well, but what the word acedia really means is to care less, okay? And so carelessness is really what it's about. And she thinks that our version of acedia is not sloth, but busyness. When you're super busy, it's virtually impossible to do anything well, to really be mindful of what you're doing. What you're run by is your schedule, and just getting things done becomes the goal, because you're so busy there's no end to what you have to do, whether it's your job or your kids or running your kids to soccer games or whatever. I mean, we're all very familiar with acedia in that sense. And I think it's a brilliant idea to help people see that there are many ways of being careless. And authenticity requires mindfulness. It requires attention. It requires, great discipline and effort and artistry. And that's why people, I think, even though they want it, they may not be aware of it, but they desire it, also shy away from it because it's not an easy thing.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Bob Sessions, author of Becoming Real, Authenticity in an Age of Distractions. And Bob is joining us from Iowa City today. And I wanted to mention I've got a press release about an international writing program event in Iowa City on Monday, October 17th at 7 p.m., the Tibetan writer Jamyang Norbu and Tibetan visual artist Tenzing Rigdol will be discussing their recent projects. Norbu will read from his work, and both artists are going to be talking about the role of Tibetan artists in exile. So that's interesting.
Where is that going to be held, does it say?
It's at EPB 107, which I don't know exactly where that is, but...
That's the English and Philosophy Building.
Okay.
It's down under the viaduct.
Okay, down, yes.
It's just...
near the library.
Two buildings north of the library, yeah.
Okay.
So that would be a very interesting discussion, I'm sure. That they'd have... I imagine they'd have something to tell us about authenticity, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Bob, in your... book, you talk a lot about the importance of nature. Why is connection with nature important in becoming real?
Yeah, that's the section that I wanted to read an excerpt from. So can
we
turn to that?
Let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So this in some ways is the hardest connection, because if the positive psychologists are correct, that we are social through and through, then if we get our social life, our political life, and so on straight, doesn't that take care of authenticity? And my contention is no, that we need to spend significant time and attention to ourselves as members of larger natural communities, and that would not only, dramatically help to reduce our environmental difficulties, but it would also help with our quest for authenticity. So that's the challenge. And so here's the excerpt from that chapter. It's on nature deficit disorder. Begins with a quote from Holmes Ralston III, who is an environmental philosopher. Become a three-dimensional person. A totally urban life is one-dimensional. One needs experience of the urban, the rural, and the wild. Otherwise, you will be underprivileged, which is an interesting way to put it. So here's what I have to say about that. In a recent book, Richard Love coins an evocative label for the phenomenon of children in many contemporary societies today suffering from nature deficit disorder. And I'm sure you and many of the people in your audience have read that book or at least heard that idea. He and a growing number of educators, psychologists, parents, and many others are increasingly concerned that children are missing something vital by spending so little time outdoors playing, exploring, and being. Many physics teachers believe children who do not spend enough time actively manipulating the physical world lack an orientation crucial to comprehending basic physics. Environmentalists contend that because we tend to view as normal what we love and experience as children, people who lacked immersion in nature when they were young tend to view the natural world as mere resource or as a place to fear and have a difficult time comprehending our fundamental membership in biotic communities. Epidemiologists fear that children's immune systems will not develop adequate vigor if they do not eat their peck of dirt. Recent studies show that Americans are increasingly suffering from vitamin D deficiency because of lack of sun exposure, and so on. The list is very long. My contention is that a nature deficit makes being authentic very difficult. But then I take up the challenge. But if the authentic self is social, what else would retreating to nature be except an opportunity to relax from the rigors of being that self? As a beginning attempt to answer this question, consider the place of humans in classical Chinese landscape paintings, where on a large canvas, say 3 feet square, humans might be an inch tall, perhaps in a corner at the bottom, and non-human nature would fill the remainder. Mm-hmm. What time in nature gives one is perspective, an existential understanding of one's place in the cosmos, the realization that humans are but a small part of the diversity, complexity, and harmony of Earth's ecosystems and their histories. And if this is true, then a major part of our identity, like it or not, includes our place in nature. To be true to whom we truly are means that we must be aware of and in tune with our membership in Earth's larger communities. Virtually all ecological ethics includes the idea that we are citizens of communities that include at least all living beings, and that we will not cease our environmental destruction until we accept the implications of such citizenship. Mm-hmm. As a marker of how far we are from this perspective, usually people today view as quaint Native American or other indigenous people references to animals and plants as relatives. Primitive animism, as this view is often called, is typically categorized as an early or an immature form of religion practiced by people who had to be so familiar with other creatures in order to survive that they anthropomorphized them, dubbing them brothers, cousins, grandfathers, or aunts. People in Aboriginal traditions around the world continue to feel they should treat nature and its beings as sacred, as members of their extended communities, lest they fail to carry out their original instructions. They believe not to follow these instructions is to transgress the sacred order of things and risk calamity. As V.F. Cordova, another person that I've learned a great deal from, a Navajo whose philosophy has provided much guidance in my exploration of the in-between nature of the self and authenticity, and whose ideas I'm going to explore later in a succeeding chapter, human beings are a part of a whole that is greater than the individual. She goes on to say, human is not something apart from the earth and the rest of its creatures, including rocks, trees, water, and air. He is a natural part of the earth. And I would add, an earth is a natural part of us.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other points in that section. The genius of using human terms, aunts and uncles and cousins, grandfathers and so on, to relate to the creatures and systems which are members of our extended communities, is that we have a whole set of features built into our language and practices that tell us to proceed in certain careful ways. We have ethics built into the basic terms and relations of our social communities. And this relates then to my definition of authenticity, which is that it's tied up with with our stories that we have of that we tell about ourselves, that we hear from each other, and so on. Let's see if I can find my definition in the book.
I've come to believe that the power of the story you tell about you tell yourself about yourself, you know, defines your life in many ways. And I'm in the process now of realizing I need to change my own story a bit. I've been quite happy with it up till now, and but it's taken on an element that I need to let go of.
Right. Yeah. Well, Ken Wilber, who you're probably familiar with, talks about developmental stages and so on. He's very much a psychologist, and he believes that it's really a point from the philosopher Hegel, and that's that as societies, but as individuals as well, develop, they don't just transcend the old story, whatever that might be. You know, the old science is replaced by the new science and so on. But the old is carried with us. It becomes part of that story. And so it's not a matter of throwing out the old and bringing in a new. It's a matter of increasingly adequate stories. You can see this when you think about people, for example, and their relationship to a holy text like the Bible. We start out as children with very simple understandings and hermeneutics or interpretive frameworks for understanding texts. And it takes a lot of work to develop a more sophisticated idea so that Santa Claus doesn't have to be a real person in order for that to be a powerful story. Or Noah doesn't have to have actually existed; could be actually a mythical figure. It doesn't matter. That it's the story that counts. It's the meaning that's fundamental. And so here's my definition. I believe authenticity is about living actionable narratives, that is, stories that provide gravity and meaning, and tie us into meaningful stories of our communities. Becoming authentic is an ongoing quest through which we can ripen as human beings. So you see, it's about stories or narratives, and it's about developing ever more adequate ones.
And it's not necessarily a single fixed goal.
Oh, no. I mean, we each have our own unique stories and our own common stories. I mean, after all, you and I are Iowans, okay? What does it mean to be an Iowan?
Right.
And the closest most people come is, well, we're Hawkeye football fans.
Well, when I was teaching...
That's not much to hang your hat on. That's a pretty inadequate understanding. But on the other hand, it shows that it's really about meaning. It's about common understanding and history and values and so on. And what one psychologist says that we have storied minds. Okay, the way that we go at the world is with a set of narratives that we then take in whatever occurs and try to make sense of it based on those stories. And so whether or not we have a culture which helps us to become authentic, okay, and a lot of cultures don't, a lot of societies don't, depends on the adequacy of the stories that bind those people together, okay? And so if we're to become authentic, then we have to live in or we have to help create societies and communities which have edifying stories, stories that build us up individually and collectively at the same time.
Well, when I was teaching high school students American literature, early American literature is difficult because of the language and the writers. And so I would tell the students, I know you don't relate to this in your life, but this is where we came from. This is our background. This is how our country was formed. This is why we have to study this, because you have to know about this. You have to have at least a passing knowledge of these people, and even if you can't remember what they wrote specifically, to know that they were writers, and I did hear about them. And I thought that was important.
Yeah. Yeah, this summer we had the privilege of visiting both Concord and Salem in Massachusetts.
Oh.
Concord, of course, is the home of Alcott and Hawthorne and Thoreau and Emerson and, you know, many, many other luminaries of the 19th century. And the people of Salem are still living with the legacy, of course, of the witch trials.
Oh, yes.
And trying to not just overcome it and not hide it, but rather learn from it and teach the rest of us about it. So it was a fascinating study. And absolutely central to that whole story of that time was Hawthorne, you know, the great writer and, you know, I think the greatest psychologist of the American psyche in the 19th century. And he really understood how the evil of the witch trials and the remnant characteristics were still haunting the Salem, you know, of his time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fascinating trip. I highly recommend it to anyone. But you know, it was all about you know, the stories, the novels, and so on that he wrote.
Well, mob psychology has always interested me in the fact that a mob will do things that an individual person would not dream of doing. And, you know, and that's
To their credit, one of the stories they're now telling is that, unfortunately, you're absolutely right, the tendency or the temptation for mob psychology is still around. They use the McCarthy era as their example, which, of course, was a play, you know, written in the 1950s about... you know, about the McCarthy trials and so on.
Bob, you talked at the beginning of the show about how you came to write this book, and I'd like to know a little bit more about the process of writing, how your writing process worked.
Mm-hmm.
This was the second book-length project that you've done in your life. Is that true?
Yeah. Actually, I have two books on the topic of work, humanities.
Okay.
Books on work, and those were readers put together for a course that we created on work back in the 80s. And so that was a very different kind of project. That was a project looking for, you know, solid, lasting pieces that gave insight into the meaning and nature of work from a humanities point of view, and then writing introductions and commentaries about those. This book was much more a reflection of my own journey through my own academic life and professional life, but also through my personal life at the same time, and how those two, you know, related to each other, dovetailed, and so on. So the raw material, you know, was fairly different, even though themes, you know, somewhat overlapped. It took me 3 years to write the book.
Wow.
You know, partly, in fact, to a great extent, because I was teaching five courses a term during the process. So I was writing, you know, between grading papers and so on. Probably the best thing that happened to me was a year and a half ago. I had a biking accident and broke my hip, and so I couldn't do very much for a while. And you know, it made me sit at the typewriter and or the computer and go at it.
The way I write is to
you know, sit down every day, as good writers always recommend, and write something. And I always sort of read what I've written before, at least in that particular section or chapter, and in the process revise. And so one of the questions you wrote on an email is, okay, how many times, how many drafts did you go through? Well, hundreds, in the sense that I was always revising. But that got me, you know, into the words and into the ideas and so on. And then when I came to the place where I needed to go on, I had a much clearer idea of where I, you know, was in the process than if I just started at that point. And I think a lot of people probably write that way.
It does seem like there's two main camps. One is that the concept that you should write your first draft completely straight through as quickly as possible. Don't stop and think about it too much. Don't edit as you go, and then go back and turn on the editor function. And then there's the way that you described, which is also seems to work really well. So I think some people do better with one method and some people with the other.
Yeah.
And combinations of the above.
You is, and I, you know, I'm not a super experienced writer, but my experience is that what I want to say I mean, this is what the idea of a muse is all about. It wasn't there in the beginning. It emerged in the process. It came from, my subconscious as much as my consciousness. So I would often wake up in the morning having figured something out that the night before, with all of my efforts, I couldn't resolve. So I really learned to trust that that deeper part of me and to let it come forth. And as the book went on, I got to be a better writer, I think. My wife, who's a professional writer, mentioned that a number of times. But secondly, the book became clearer and clearer. And the last several chapters basically wrote themselves. I mean, I didn't have to put much effort in.
Wow. We're speaking with Bob Sessions today, the author of Becoming Real, Authenticity in an Age of Distractions. So, Bob, when did you decide how to structure the book? Was that something you did up front, or did the structure come out of the process?
A little bit of both. I had a fairly clear idea of the elements that I wanted to have at the beginning, but just which chapters came first and what to do in each chapter as a part of it, because while they're on themes like work and technology and so on, I had very specific things that I wanted those chapters to accomplish in my overall structure. But some of that didn't become clear until I was well into the book.
Now, did you research? I mean, there's a lot of references to other books, other writers, other philosophies in this. Did you research as you went, or did you already know all of that?
Well, both. I, falling on a lot of years of
teaching
conversations and so on. and I've written many articles and published many articles, so I was calling on that. But I also was doing research as I was going. I would come to an idea and say, well, gee, I wonder what people have to say about this today, because I was thinking about somebody who had written about it 10 mm-hmm. years ago or 20 mm-hmm. years ago. So it was both.
Now, do you think that, you say you just retired from teaching, but do you think writing this book made you a better teacher?
Well, in the sense that I think it refamiliarized me with the inchoate nature of learning. We begin without a lot of clarity, and it takes a while for that to emerge. It takes effort and discipline, but as I say, it also takes letting go. It takes trusting our deeper aspects.
Bob, tell us a little bit about the publishing process for you. How did you connect with Ice Cube Press? And
well, publishing these days, of course, I'm sure you're aware, is a very difficult business. I mean, books are not disappearing altogether, but it's very difficult to get something published, especially by the bigger houses. You have to usually have an agent. You have to have something full grown. A lot of publishers won't accept manuscripts unsolicited. You have to go through a very lengthy process. I tried a number of places, and Steve Semkin, Ice Cube Press publisher, is a friend of mine. He goes to our church, and so I was talking to him about it, and he expressed real interest in it. I showed him some early material, and he really liked it. And so it just kind of fell into place. I never had in mind that this would go viral and sell millions of copies. I mean, very, very few people make much money on books. But rather, I wanted the opportunity to put my ideas out there for myself and for the people I know and who might find it interesting and valuable, and if it finds a lot larger audience, that's wonderful. But I certainly don't expect that, and so going with a smaller publisher was not particularly a problem for me. Also, in this day of publishing, smaller publishers aren't necessarily a hindrance, because the main thing is to have it on Amazon, because that's what everybody checks.
Right. Yeah.
But also to try to get it reviewed. You know, if you get a good review in New York Review of Books or New York Times Book Review, I mean, you got it made. Not expecting that, but whether or not it's reviewed doesn't have to do simply with it being published by Scribner's or Beacon Press or something like that. So I decided for all those reasons that going with Steve would be a good idea. And he's been terrific to work with. He, unlike major publishers, keeps books in print a very long time. He's very supportive that way, and helps to find at least local and regional venues like your program. And so I really am very happy with publishing with Steve.
Do you think this book might possibly become a textbook at some point?
Yeah, I could see it used in a
mm-hmm.
course.
I could too.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I haven't had anyone approach me about that yet, or I haven't heard about it, but I would be most happy if that would happen.
Yeah, that would be good.
Great. Well, Bob, thank you so much for being with us today on Writers' Voices. We're about out of time. And
my pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity, and it's wonderful to be on a program with a mother and daughter.
One quick last question. Are you writing another book?
Not at the moment. my muse has not been tickled.
Okay, well, let us know when it is.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So before we close today, I do want to mention again the International Writing Program in Iowa City and the Iowa Museum of Art are presenting a unique opportunity to engage with Tibetan writer Jamyang Norbu and Tibetan visual artist Tenzing Rigdal, where they will share their recent work, address questions specific to their artistic practice, and more broadly about the role of Tibetan artists in exile. And that's the English and Philosophy Building, 107, Monday, October 17th, 7 p.m. And you can check the University of Iowa website for more information.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you have a good turnout for that, because it sounds very interesting.
Yeah, maybe I might try and make it up there myself. So, Mom, you got some closing words of wisdom for us?
A lot of closing. This one is from Red Skeleton, so you know it's on a light vein. All men make mistakes, but married men find out about them sooner.
Stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore if you're listening to us on Friday, and see you next week on Writers' Voices.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.